Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And we're going to start the show today by talking with the author of a book that profiles sports scientists helping athletes move better and avoiding injury. Let's not have the injury. Let's do things that we can do to not have it in the first place. Henry Abbott's our guest. He is the founder of True Hoop. It's a medical a media company focused on the NBA. Previously, he was the leader of ESPN's coverage of the NBA. And he is the author of the book Ballistic, The New Science of Injury-Free Performance. It's published just in May by W.W. Norton. And as we talk with Henry, I hope you'll join in. You want to know how to prevent injury while staying active? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Henry Abbott, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
It's an honor to be here. I used to live in Madison, and I've listened to a lot of WPR, so it's great to be on your show.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book, Ballistic. Well, it is a fascinating read. There's a lot of science involved in it, but you write it in such a way that any of us can understand it. And the stories you tell about the athletes are amazing. You start, though, I think I have a bunch of notes here from my reading of it. We aren't moving, and it's killing us.
It is outrageous. They have those little notes that would be like an ad for something on TV, and they'll say, consult with your doctor before starting an exercise program. And I was like, where's the doctor who says it's okay not to start an exercise program, right? The thing that I'm citing all the time is the World Health Organization. At the time I was writing the book, had a little report saying that inactivity was the globe's fourth leading cause of death. And immobility makes almost every disease worse, you know, all kinds of cancers and mental disease and all these things that are contributing to premature death are related to just being still.
Yeah. And you know, you've been a journalist, you've covered professional sports for 25 years. Talk about when you started thinking about career-ending injuries suffered by talented athletes.
Well, I'm going to say this, you know, I use this word with love, but I'm kind of a dork, right? I'm pretty into like evidence-based approaches to things. And I was covering the league, and the evidence was that NBA players were getting hurt all the time. At one point, I was in a meeting with an injury expert, and he said that the NBA has a 100% injury rate. Like, there's no Cal Ripken in this sport. Everybody gets hurt, right? And the longer you go without getting hurt, the closer you are to your next injury, basically, right? So right now, I think the reigning king there's a Knicks player, Mikal Bridges, who's gone maybe 6 years without an injury, but that's unusual, right? Usually everyone's getting hurt. So that seemed like a bummer. It seemed like it was this big force that was kind of wrecking everything that was fun about basketball. And at the same time, I was going through, like a lot of the listeners, I'm sure, my own little issues. And it seemed like we were all in the same boat. It seemed like these players and I were all seeking out the same, you know, yoga instructors, physical therapists, you know, that kind of underground network of just people who might have some magic for the soft tissue, solutions. And it just felt like way too big of a problem to have such a haphazard approach to.
Yeah. And you, there's one spot where you talk about the three horsemen of the free movement apocalypse: radiology, surgery, and pharma. Mm-hmm. I think he's something like who circle athletes like vultures, eager to feast.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the model. Is we run around, do whatever you want to do, however you want to do it, and then something starts hurting bad enough, and then you go see the three horsemen, and they don't care if you're going to move again, right? Like, they might get you back to work. They might get you back driving a car. But they don't care if your life is fun anymore. And I do care about that. I think it's fun to go for a bike ride. It's fun to go skiing. It's fun to, you know, move in these ways. It's important. It's fun to play in the waves with your kids, right? Like, this stuff matters. So I know that Wisconsin's kind of far from waves. I get that. Like, but,
well, but, you know, we've got Lake Mendota right here in Madison. And
are there waves, though? Yeah. Is waves a thing?
Well, kind of.
The wind is right.
Oh, man. Well, you know, your book's largely about Marcus Elliott, who is the coolest guy. Talk a little bit about Marcus Elliott.
He's one of one. You know, there aren't a lot of people like that guy. I spend a lot of time with him. And the first rule of spending time with him was I was not going to sit down and interview him. That's not how he works. He's not going to be sitting in a chair for 3 hours. I think I ended up interviewing him 44, 45 times, and each one was hours. But almost every single one of them was a massive, like 4,000 foot mountain climb on a bicycle or hiking up all in the hills above Santa Barbara. If you know Santa Barbara, there's a road called Gibraltar Road, which is sort of it used to be the kind of the most difficult climb of the Tour of California, the bike race. I reported this book, climbing that hill again and again and again, where I have my little questions strapped to the handlebars and he's wearing AirPods and I'm recording a voice memo of his answers. And so I have all these transcripts of me sounding like, and he's like, well, anyway, the thing about Harvard Medical School is just like totally unflapped. But he tore his ACL on his 17th birthday at football practice, and he just got super depressed about it. And his football dreams were dashed. And he resolved to spend the rest of his life doing what he's still doing now. He's approaching 60, just to figure out how to prevent the injuries that ruin sports. And it took him to Harvard Medical School and these top physiologists in South Africa he studied with, and he worked for the New England Patriots and the Seattle Mariners. And for the last 20 odd years, he's had this lab in Santa Barbara called P3, where 70% of the NBA has been assessed there, a whole bunch of Major League Baseball players and all athletes from every elite sport. And the trick is, rather than just running around and getting hurt, you get a million data points of this super detailed movement assessment of, you know, you move around for an hour, exploding right and left and up and down, and all the data goes on the servers. And then they say to you, you know, with the way that you move, Larry, you're at a little bit elevated risk for Achilles tear or lower back pain. And so let's move over a few yards. And it's a full service gym where really smart people are going to train you how to strengthen and add mobility to the things that are causing you elevated injury risk.
Yeah, there the his training areas, unlike sort of the typical training areas that you see with you know, the dumbbells and you know, a very closed in kind of thing. It's wide open.
Yeah, when he took over the Mariners training, they had, I mean, his line is that, you know, you couldn't take a long step in that building. They had so much equipment in there, right? And he's like, sport is about movement, but you couldn't move in there. And he said they had three different calf raise machines. So he got rid of almost everything. It almost looks like a dance floor, the P3 workout area. And people are doing big, explosive, free movements. The sort of crowning achievement thing I've seen NBA players do is they line up these tall, don't do this at home, by the way. This one is an elite move. But they would line up five very tall boxes in a row, those like plyometric boxes, some of which were, you know, 48 inches high, that kind of height. And then they just on 2 feet just bounce in a row over all of them without touching them. And it's the forces involved in that are massive, but they would train you to get ready to do that. And it's pretty awesome kind of free movement.
He became and is pretty good at looking at someone and watching them train a little bit and telling me, here's what's going to happen to you.
Yeah, yes, that's totally true. He doesn't like to talk about that because he's trying to be the Pied Piper of, we're going to move this to science and away from like these kind of guru model of, you know, like things happening in magical ways. So he would like to direct you to think, but the fact is he does have a crazy track record of, there's so many anecdotes. One of them is like a Utah Jazz player was there and they've been training him and training him to try to get at more mobility in his hips because that was adding to his injury risk. And Marcus, I don't know what he saw, but he's like, oh, well, it looks like maybe he has a deformed femoral head. Like the top of his like the bony part of the top of his leg can't move the way you want it to because it's bone on bone. I don't know. I can't conceive of how a human would know that. And then sure enough, they sent him for an MRI, and that's exactly what it was. There are a lot of stories like that. Yeah, it's weird.
It's strange. And there's one where he has them start on a box that's 18 mm-hmm. inches mm-hmm. high. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a ballistic part of it in a way, I guess.
So this is a standard part of the assessment. They would have. I've done it. My daughter's done it. NBA players have done it, where you stand on an 18-inch tall box, and you just step off, and then you land on with your right foot on one force plate and your left foot on another, and then you jump up as high as you can. And the information is coming from infrared cameras in the ceiling, sensors on your body, and the force plates in the floor, all of which are very sensitive instruments. And this particular move exposes a lot. And for instance, one of the big findings is that one NBA player landed with 11,000 newtons of force. It only takes 3,000 something newtons of force to fully sever a human spine. So what that tells us is we're blatantly counting on our legs to attenuate this force, right? Your ankles, knees, and hips are going to bend in unison. And then they can cope with 11,000 newtons of force, which is almost a car crash amount of force. But we can cope with it, which is amazing. But it can't cope with it if you use those joints in screwy ways. And that's what they're detecting is, for instance, I have the habit of when my ankles and knees bend, my hips don't join the party properly. So a lot of the force that would ideally go into my glutes go into my lower back and have caused me lower back pain. Other people have a common issue would be that you land on the outside of your foot and have the force roll to the inside, which in their giant database emerges as the number one movement associated with ACL tears in the knee, is this thing that no doctor knows about. One doctor knows about, I guess, where you know, it's from a big data set. There are all sorts of other things. Another thing they really notice is landing toes down is common.
Yeah,
but it leads to massive forces. So all the biggest forces, those 11,000 newtons I was talking about, come from people who land toes down, because after your toes land, then here comes your heel, which is bony and hard and pushing the force of your whole torso down into the ground, and it smacks the ground really hard. And those forces can do a lot of damage.
You can train somebody to land toes up?
They do it all the time. Yeah, yeah. It is. All these things are changeable. It literally is just in your brain. It's analogous and contiguous with the part of your brain that learns language. So just as you can learn to speak a little differently or speak another language, you can learn to move a little differently.
And just speaking of the brain, you get into the brain, or he gets into the brain a bit, which is sort of our central governor, I think he called mm-hmm. it. If you're mm-hmm. running, the brain knows how to make you stop on the one hand. If you're going to the point it's going to kill you, the brain can slow you down.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, the brain also, it makes a big difference of how fast you believe you mm-hmm. can run. Mm-hmm. Or how good you feel before you take your golf shot or your putt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there used to be this thing called the Harvard Fatigue Laboratory, where they had like a hot room and a cold room and a low altitude room, and they would just essentially abuse people by putting them through all these trials to see what they could deal with. This was back in like the 40s. Mm-hmm. And then they did a bit of research on soldiers for World War II, and like, you know, how hot can a soldier serve in North Africa before they're going to pass out, this kind of stuff. And what they found was there aren't really easily definable limits to humans. Like, we can deal with almost an infinite amount, but what stops you isn't physiology. It isn't like the capacity of your blood flow or your muscle tissue. It's your brain. And so what that means is if you want to get better at, you know, well, I'm in the Northeast today where the topic would be coping with heat, right? That's what we're dealing with. But if you want to get better at coping with heat, the thing that you're working against isn't so much your body's absolute physical limits. It's your brain having the firing up the central governor and sending the shutdown signals to you. So effectively, a lot of modern athletic training is not so much designing to get your muscles stronger or your VO2 max bigger, but instead to get your brain to back off when it wants to send a little panic signal for you to shut down. Because they've done a lot of research. Let's say two runners finish a marathon in within like a few seconds of each other, the physiological attacks is identical, but one of them just had a brain that let them go a little faster, right? So you want to do the kind of training where you're going to calm your brain down. And there's lots of ways to do this. Sprinting, lifting heavy weights, they kind of have this effect of like, look, brain, I'm showing you how strong I am. You know, like, trust me next time.
and the feel part of it, too, it was interesting to me. There's a golf course I play once in a while. And I, the first time I played it, I came to this hole, and you're hitting across a gorge to a fairly narrow spot with trees on both sides of that spot.
Sounds beautiful.
It is. And the first time I played it, I was feeling pretty good. Oh, I can make this. And I'm not normally that good a shot, but I made it. And, you know, every time I played that hole, I have made that course. I've made that shot, even though two shots later I might be spraying it somewhere. But I know I can make that shot, and I make it. I make it every single time because I just have that feel. I know I can do it.
Well, what you're not doing is panicking, right?
Right.
You're. The trick to most of these things is to behave just like, so if there's a gorge, the trick is to behave like there isn't a gorge, right? Like just swing it the way you swing it all the time, right? We don't need special gorge effort. We just need how Larry swings is the way you want to swing it, right? And it's your brain that will freak out sometimes. And so I think there's like, this is why they have athletes do things like get in the cryotherapy chamber or in the ice bath or these things that could inspire panic, but where you're actually totally fine, right? And the whole trick is just to be like, you know what? I'm okay. I can handle this. It feels a little uncomfortable. It's a little panicky. You know, there's a gorge, but I got it. I've been doing this my whole life, right? I think that's kind of the message of a lot of this, is your body can deal with a lot more than you think it can.
Henry Abbott, our guest today, his book, a fascinating book and entertaining as well. It's titled Ballistic, the subtitle, The New Science of Injury-Free Athletic Performance. Questions or comments for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News, talking with Henry Abbott about his book, Ballistic, The New Science of Injury-Free Athletic Performance. And again, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Well, Marcus Elliott says baseball is definitely the dumbest sport. And explain why he said that. He gave an interesting talk.
Things have changed a little. Honestly, they've had more experience with baseball since the book came out and since I finished writing the book. And so he would like to revise that slightly now to baseball's like coming around. But you know, he has this career of trying to convince people to change their habits. And that's hard to do, right? Including especially people who have jobs. So when he worked for the Mariners, you know, there are people who have jobs to keep the players fit. And Marcus is coming in with all of his data and all of his studies and all of his insight from Harvard Medical School. And he's young and brash and he wants to change things, right? Because he doesn't like the way it's going. But he ends up with all these, you know, a lot of people who are just super unhappy with his message. There's a particular anecdote of there was a high-paid pitcher who'd had a bunch of injuries. And as Marcus remembers it, that pitcher was with the athletic trainer and doing his third chest workout of the week. So, you know, he's just really super working on his chest, which is kind of a macho old school weightlifting thing to do. And Marcus can see these things that no one else can see, where basically he's like, look, his chest is so overdeveloped that it's pulling on the shoulder that he injured, and it's going to make it worse. And so Marcus is hoping that they'll change his routine to be more varied. And so he, you know, marches over there and says, hey, you guys, I think this is like a little too much chest workout. And then the players, like, basically the player said, I don't like people who try to figure things out. And I think somewhere in there is why he said baseball is the dumbest sport.
He calls it a rotational sport.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing. A lot of P3's findings are that rotating is something we should all be practicing more. By that, I mean like actually turning your body. And the workouts I do that they assign me have a surprising amount of rotating. And the thing that really blows my mind is, and this is not true in basketball, and it's not true in football, it's not true in soccer, but in baseball, everybody who plays high-level professional baseball played before the age of 12. And Marcus's theory is that if you don't get the neurological development to be a very good rotator, which is biomechanically very complex, a lot of ways it can go wrong or be inefficient, but that's when you're throwing and hitting, you're rotating your core. And his idea is if you don't grow up practicing that, you'll never get good enough to make the majors.
Yeah. Well, and the training that was going on, having pitchers, for example, run sprints and so forth. No.
Yeah, that's a big battle. Yeah. Yeah. So Marcus was invited to speak at the baseball winter meetings to the athletic trainers of baseball. And his big mess. And so this is, I mean, he didn't have to do it this way, but he said, hey, who in the room has their players do what they call a flush run? So this is where pitchers will have a big, you know, throw 100 pitches on Tuesday night. And then Wednesday, the tradition of baseball would be you'd send that guy to do like a 3 or 4 or 5 mile run to flush the lactic acid out of his system. So Marcus had them do a show of hands. And everybody raised their hand. And then he explained how stupid they were. and I could go into it more if you want, but yeah. The idea is basically it actually makes it worse. And that's how that was kind of his intro to baseball. So you can see why, you know, it wasn't like a match made in heaven.
Well, and the rotation, you know, it's kind of interesting. We've got a new pitcher. The Brewers, Milwaukee Brewers have a new pitcher. Just Jacob Mizorowski, you may have heard about him. His first 11 innings of pitching as a pro were no hitters.
Oh, wow. Nice job, Jacob.
So, he pitched 5 innings of no-hit ball, and then he pitched 6 innings of no-hit ball. But I saw a little film of him working out, and his... I was looking at what he was doing, and I thought, those are the rotational things that
oh, totally.
Marcus was talking about. The kinds of exercises and things he were doing was quite a bit different than anything I'd seen in other pitchers. Well, it's pretty cool. Let's talk about the first professional athlete he had was a volleyball player.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love this story. So there's this moment of beach volleyball where they were just starting to get televised and the league was trying to do everything they could to make money for the first time. This was, I wish I remembered the year. I want to say it was in the 90s.
Yeah.
And the guy who was actually the commissioner of the league was Shaquille O'Neal's agent, interestingly enough. But, so they're anyway, that at that time they're getting big. What one of the biggest, most important players in the league dumped his teammate, their teams of two, to join with another team whose teammate was injured, which meant there were two professional beach volleyball players who in the middle of the season didn't have teammates. And so they called themselves the Dumpies and they joined together. But one of them was super injured. His name is Dax Holdren. And some doctors told me he was never going to play again. But Dax found Marcus. And Marcus was putting him through all sorts of crazy different trainings. And Dax started to feel like he was getting better. And it's all like in the middle of the season when they're trying to play every weekend, travel around. And so Dax convinced his new partner, whose name is Stein Metzger, to come train with Marcus. And Stein, who I interviewed, was like a great guy. He's the head volleyball coach at Texas now. But Stein did not want to train with Marcus, did not want to go to Santa Barbara. He had his own routine. He was doing very well. And then he found, when he got there, Marcus that time was running P3 out of the back of a friend's physical therapy lab. And Stein was like, this is just the most Mickey Mouse kind of silly thing ever. And long story short, the Dumpies made the Olympics. Like, they only had a few weeks left of the season, but they played so well. They changed position. They trained differently. They got over the injuries, and they beat the teammates who had dumped them, and off to the races.
I love that. You cite some research that a simple prevention program cut ACL injuries by 64%. I know a lot of people listening have had, raising my own hand here, have had ACL injuries. How do we prevent tearing ours?
It's funny. It's this terrible epidemic, especially in women's sports, you know, where I think women athletes are about 8 times more likely to have ACL tear. And yet there have been prevention programs around for decades that are highly effective. There's actually, I got that 64% number from a white paper that was basically saying, when the science is so good, this is one of the best interventions we know about. Like, the problem isn't how do we prevent ACL injuries, it's how do we make these programs popular. And that is running along this track of, you know, people have been trying to prevent ACL injuries in soccer players and such for a long time. At the same time, P3 is doing their own independent studying of what causes ACL tears. And they're landing at a very similar place as these programs, which is basically, it's about how we land. It's about how your foot hits the ground. It's about the muscles in your lower leg. And it's about what your hips do when you land. Of P3's leading factors contributing to catastrophic knee injuries, which are predominantly ACL tear, none of those factors are in the knee. It's not about how your knee moves or how strong your knee is. It's about your foot and your hip. All of the big causes come from there. So these programs that exist are essentially teaching people how to land, which ends up solving the problems P3 says are the cause, where you have weak muscles in your lower leg, or you land on the outside of your foot, or your hips don't bend as you land. There's all sorts of different causes of ACL tear. One of the big ones is, this is kind of gross, but your femur, your upper leg bone. Some people have their femur rotate as they land, which is like twisting the drumstick off the turkey, right? It tears the ACL by rotating. You can fix that. There are muscles in your hip that you can strengthen that will hold your femur from rotating. Anyway, so these kinds of things are trainable if we train how to land. There are programs that are commonly available. It's somewhat common in women's soccer to do them now, but it probably should be more of us. All of us maybe should do these programs to learn how to land.
You talk about players who spend hours stretching and strengthening their core, but it has nothing to do with the core. The cores are typically perfectly strong and flexible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is one of the earliest P3 findings in studying NBA players, was that some of them don't, a third of them don't use their hips properly when landing. So the ankles bend, the knees bend, then the glutes don't bend. And so then you can see, you know, a lot of times they just keep saying, like, what we do is high school physics, it's super basic. You can see the force that would go into the hips instead just goes up into the lower back. And indeed, once they started digging into the numbers, players who have this habit of not bending their hips when they land are 300% more likely to miss games owing to lower back pain. This, by the way, is also what I do. They call these people blenders. And so this is an absolutely novel discovery of what causes lower back pain. And, you know, our doctors and physical therapists aren't thinking about this, aren't screening for it. And so what happens if you have lower back pain is they generally just try to get you to strengthen and stretch your core. But that's not, if you keep landing like this when you jog or even, you know, walk down the stairs, then you're going to keep putting these forces that should be going into your glutes, into your lower back, and you're going to keep making it worse. So there's this kind of biomechanical cause from your hips for lower back pain that they keep studying it in different populations, and it keeps being the same. It's about a third of people meet this criteria, and you can fix it.
Steven Stoughton has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for the conversation. I'm 67, pretty athletic. I still play soccer. I'm going to be doing a major through hike in September of the John Muir Trail. And I was just thinking, I've already learned a few things from the conversation, which is great. So now I'm going to read the book. But my question is, how does footwear play into athletic, injury-free athletic performance? And, you know, what kind of technologies are current that help out as far as footwear goes?
And you, Henry, you spend some time, a bit of time on footwear.
That was kind of a setup. I feel like maybe Steve's like a, is Steve your friend, Larry?
No.
Thank you, Steve, for the question. Yeah, there's a whole chapter on footwear, and the answer is that in Marcus's view, the footwear companies, they spend a fair amount of money on research and development, but not on injury prevention in research and development. And so they, P3 has partnerships with various different shoe companies, but they have not yet really opened the book on, you know, having one athlete wear several different shoes with several different components and see how that affects their biomechanics, which to Marcus would be upstream from really using shoes to reduce injuries. And there is a study, there's a lower extremity review research showing that basically athletic shoes have never been shown to reduce injuries. So we're a little bit in the dark on shoes. I think in the meantime, I'll tell you a couple of things. One, Marcus is very livid that standard athletic shoes have a 10 millimeter drop from heel to toe. That encourages you to land toes down, which you probably heard me say earlier, like, you know, increases the forces you impact the ground with because your toes hit and then your heel hits and it's a bony impact. So we're all different. We have different shoes, different needs in shoes. Some people might need that kind of support, but I think that one that feels most comfortable to you when you try on lots of shoes in the shoe store, which you can't do when you buy them online, is probably helpful. And mostly I think the idea is that shoes won't save us. The little bit of rubber underneath you is fairly insignificant in cushioning the forces of falling. And really you want to have the musculature of your hip and lower leg be what absorbs most of the forces. You hike the John Muir Trail, which I'm super jealous of. yeah, that sounds like they're really fun.
Oh yeah. And you did get into Nike with their carbon plates and so forth, for runners, long distance runners. And
yeah, there's a crazy thing. So some athletes, like elite athletes, every elite runner is good and efficient at landing. So if you can take the force of landing, so this is like this kind of crashing down, all the weight of your body is going to free fall into the ground and running. If you have good biomechanics and good musculature, then you can cope with that. And so then a carbon plate shoe, which Marcus maybe kind of invented. They had a starter shoe company called Ampla. You can look it up. There's a vivid description in the book of how we got here, but this was before any of the major shoe companies had carbon plates and anything. And Marcus was like, you know, the best athletes use the force of landing. And if you increase the impact, what happens is you stretch the rubber bands of your calves and your quads and your glutes even more. So it springs you even more into the next step. So a carbon plate shoe is great for people who are primarily concerned about being fast and have a body that's ready to land with even harder landings. It's not great for people who aren't ready to cope with landing. So it's a little bit of, you have to know your biomechanics to know if this is good for you or not. And Marcus kind of, I think unwittingly in some cases, and wittingly, he's been a forerunner of a lot of innovations in shoes. And I think that's kind of continuing, to be honest. But yeah, this carbon plate thing is great if you're good at landing, is the main point.
And somebody else wants to know, are the sports medicine principles that Marcus Elliott championed catching on?
Yes. I'm not as fast as he would like, but, you know, I mentioned 70% of the NBA has been assessed by P3, and there was a league-wide deal in the NBA to install the kind of assessment equipment that they use in, at every team, and then have the data go a bunch of places, but including P3, so they can assess. I think the habit has been to keep control. So what happens is a lot of teams have purchased the equipment that P3 has, and they've hired a staffer to run it, but they keep all the data on their own servers. They don't want to share it.
Yeah.
Downside of that is, you know, you don't know what's dangerous unless you have a huge data set. You need 1,000 NBA players to say, oh, well, when this guy moves, like I mentioned that femoral rotation thing, right? Yeah. Like how much femoral rotation is okay? Like, well, you have to see over decades who tears their ACL and who doesn't to have an answer to that. So we've had this problem where the teams will have their own private, closely held information on a very small number of players, not enough to even draw conclusions. So it's just coming around now that they'll start to pool all that data. They can anonymize it and just everyone can start learning what works and what doesn't.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. You talked about the secret of aging gracefully right at the end of the book, which I thought, just to conclude here, which is essentially figure out which things are like dunking a basketball, which you probably shouldn't do anymore.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Marcus's point is fight like hell for the things that you can keep, that you want to keep, that are important. Like hit top of that list would be hip mobility, hip stability. You know, these are things that we lose with each passing year unless you fight to keep them, right? So you can literally measure how much range of motion you have in your hips or how stable your hips are with the, you know, basically how strong they are. So you want to fight like hell for those things, which you can do. But he has a story of like some super wealthy client who's in the 60s and proudly hammer dunking. And he's like, look, you just, your body doesn't, there's so many parts of your body that could break every time you land from that dunk. That, let that one go, right? You want to be graceful in giving that up, right? But we all have different things that are important to us. You know, I want to play with my grandkids. I don't have grandkids yet, but this is a goal for me, right? So I'm fighting for those things. Maybe you want to fight for, you know, golfing, right? I think you want to figure out what you are fighting for and just let the hammer dunking, let that, we don't have to have that one.
Marcus, or Henry, I should say, Marcus, Henry, I should say, it's been great talking with you today. I hope we have a chance to do this again. I loved your book and,
thank you.
I hope you sell a lot of copies. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I can tell you read it really carefully. Thank you so much. That means a lot.
Henry Abbott, our guest, his book, Ballistic, The New Science of Injury-Free Athletic Performance. It was great to have him with us, and I hope I get a chance to talk with him again. It was a lot of fun. Coming up, we're going to be talking about a bio blitz. You know what a bio blitz is? You're going to hear about that in just a couple of minutes. I'm Larry Mealer. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mealer here. You know, this weekend, more than 100 naturalists and citizen scientists will gather at the Aldo Leopold Foundation property in Baraboo to engage in what's called a bio blitz. And we're going to be talking about it today with a couple of people. Back with us, Buddy Hoffaker is the executive director and board president of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Buddy, good to have you back.
Oh, always good to be with you, Larry.
With us as well, Julia Colby. Julia is manager of the vertebrate and invertebrate collection at the Milwaukee Public Museum, which organizes the event. And Julia, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just to mention, at 12:30, we're going to be talking about a series of events highlighting the resilience of organic crops. We'll talk with Aaron Silva, program leader for the Organic Grain Resource and Information Network, hosting those events. But first, have you participated in a bio blitz? You know what it is. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Julia, this weekend is the 10th annual BioBlitz organized by the Milwaukee Public Museum. What's a BioBlitz?
It's an event that's sort of hard to describe, but in a nutshell, you get a bunch of naturalists and citizen scientists and members of the public in a park or a natural area, and they survey for 24 hours. So they're out there looking at anything they can put a name on, if it's a plant, an animal. We have somebody doing algae, fungi, and we count all those things up. And at the end of that 24 hours, we announce what we found in this snapshot in time. And then that list gets provided to the host site so that they know maybe a little bit more about what they have. And then on the Saturday portion, there is activities for the public. So if you don't necessarily want to go out there and, you know your fungi, maybe you could learn them.
What's the history of the, it's been going for 10 years, and I think it's been held in other places as well.
Yeah, so we have been doing them, MPM has been organizing them for 10 years. The history of the BioBlitz goes back, I think, 26 years, where the first one was put on at from a museum to have a general, you know, sort of festival and connect people with the nature in their area. And that's sort of the overarching goal of a BioBlitz.
It's interesting. I know there have been Canada has was trying for a countrywide BioBlitz, which was really interesting to me. Buddy, this is here's this event coming up this weekend. It's going to take place at the Foundation property in Baraboo. What does it mean to host this event?
Well, we're so excited to host the BioBlitz and for it to be the 10th anniversary of the event that Milwaukee Public Museum has organized is extra special. You know, it was 90 years ago that the Leopold family bought their farm and started restoring it back to health and reintroducing species that would have been there prior to European settlement. And so we know quite a bit about what has been done there and what's living on the property, all the wild things. And yet we're not specialists in butterflies or moss or invertebrates. And so Julia and the team of expertise that she mobilizes is just really thrilling to get a deeper insight into all the living things that we share this space with and that we're helping to care for and give habitat for.
Yeah, I'm wondering, how are you going to use those data? But probably a lot of ways.
Probably a lot of ways. I mean, you know, Leopold, just we got to get a Leopold quote in there. The first law of intelligent tinkering is to keep all the cogs and wheels. And so just knowing what's out there is important because as we make habitat management decisions, you know, invariably they help some and hurt other species. And so trying to understand what we can do to improve the quality of the habitat for those species that are struggling elsewhere or that are rare and threatened is really important. So, again, having this bigger snapshot of what it is that we can take care of, do a better job taking care of, is really important for an organization that does active management.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. Julia, so how does it work? Do people use... What do they use? I mean, they're running around in the night even. Is there an app or how does it work?
Yeah, so folks survey in a variety of different ways. They'll bring whatever field equipment is appropriate for them. And as you say, sometimes they're out there at 2 or 3 in the morning. And then that material they either identify sort of on the fly when they're out in the field, or they may bring it back to base camp to ID. Sometimes they give us a paper list of what they found. We're also using an app called iNaturalist, which allows you to record photos and other information about anything you see. You could use this anywhere. And then that you can suggest an ID, or sometimes members of, you know, the larger naturalist community who may not be even at the event will say, oh, that looks interesting, and suggest an ID for you, or they will know what it is.
If I might just jump in here, Larry, I think one of the fun parts about these kind of gatherings, too, is not only the wild things, but these wild naturalists that are out there. Some of these are professionals that really know more about a species or a guild of species than anybody else in the world, and others are volunteers that This is just their side passion and their hobby that they want to understand the world and help introduce it to others. So it's part of the fun part is also just interacting with all these specialists that are there, sharing their own commitment to conservation and then sharing their knowledge with the general public.
And I imagine there are some sort of there have to be some identification tools that get used as well.
Yeah, so we bring field guides for scientists to use because obviously we have a fairly large library at the museum. People bring their own field guides, their own microscopes, and then having that sort of backbone that iNaturalist provides, where somebody might be, you know, going to look at fly data from California or they're in California and they see these new observations pop up and they say, oh, that's that, that's that, that's that. And so that's very helpful too.
It's interesting to me that I'm trying to envision some, now there's not, people aren't out there 24 straight hours.
Some of them are.
Oh.
Some people, you know, they might sneak off and have a nap for a little while, but there's definitely years where there's some wild person out there and they are just up for the 24 hours out there surveying.
It's hard for me to imagine being out there for 24 hours.
Well, when you
Buddy,
love
are
something.
You, are you going to be out there for 24
well,
hours?
Well, I'm pretty sure I'll sneak a nap in here or there. I'm not very good after 4 hours, so. And then just also want to make sure we share that not only do you have the chance to rub elbows with these people who know more about wild things than most of us, but that we have some structured events and activities that people can come out and participate in, a moss walk, a mycology walk, a butterfly hike. So you can get out and build your own knowledge about the wild things that you share this planet with as well.
And will that be going concurrently with the rest of it?
Correct. Julia has kind of structured the schedule. Maybe you want to describe a little bit more what's going on and how things lay against one another.
Yeah, so on Saturday is when all the sort of public-facing events happen, and that's between 10 and 3, and it's really just sort of drop in as you want. The schedule is available on the MPM website, but the programming starts at 10, and then at 3, as I said, we announce the totals of everything that we found, and in between you can take these walks. Self-guided tours of the Leopold Shack will be available. You can wander through base camp and chat with the scientists and learn about what they're doing or how they're doing it, or show them a picture of something you found and be part of the Blitz.
It sounds like a whole lot of people running around.
Structured chaos.
That's a great way of describing it, yes.
It's hard for me to imagine all that happening at the same time. And I'm looking here for a piece of information that I lost that I was going to bring up. And I'll find it. I promise I'll find it. We're talking today with Buddy Huffaker, Executive Director and Board President for the Aldo Leopold Foundation based in Baraboo. And Julia Colby is the manager of the Vertebrate and Invertebrate Collection at the Milwaukee Public Museum about this BioBlitz. And BioBlitzes, and certainly we're inviting you to join in. Julia, you could talk a little bit about how the public museum got involved in this in the first place and what's the background of it. And you know what? I think we're going to save that. But think about that, and we'll come back to that after we take a look at the news. We find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. This coming weekend, scientists and interested citizens will have 24 hours to identify every plant and animal species in the Aldo Leopold Foundation property in Baraboo, which I think is for about 4,000 acres. And we're talking about that event and some other things as well with our two guests, Buddy Huffaker, Executive Director and Board President for the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and Julia Colby, Manager of the Vertebrate and Invertebrate Collection at the Milwaukee Public Museum, which organizes the event. And they're here until 12:30 to answer your questions, and then we'll talk with Aaron Silva, Program Leader for Organic Grain Resource and Information Network, about a series of upcoming events about organic farming. Questions for our guests for now, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. Julia, when we broke for news, we were talking a little bit about the Milwaukee Public Museum. What's the background on this, and talk about the museum a bit?
Yeah, so as we talked about earlier, the first BioBlitz was about 26 years ago, and that was in D.C., and our president and CEO helped organize that when she was at a different institution. And 10 years ago, we were looking for some outreach opportunities that would involve all parts of the museum and would allow us to connect both to scientists in the community, connect them to each other, and connect to the public. And a BioBlitz was sort of the natural thing for us to do. And we have, you know, we've done one every year since, except for 2020. And it just, every year it grows and grows, and we meet new folks, and we get new audiences to come in. And it's just a really fun event.
Yeah, I was thinking on June 7th, the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve held a BioBlitz to study the biodiversity of a 300-acre natural area on campus. How do you feel seeing similar events held in other places?
I love it. I think that this is a great way to sort of, again, mobilize all of those scientists who most of them got into this because they love going out there and poking around at stuff and putting names on things and learning about the world that surrounds them. And so when you say, hey, if you want to come do this, I'll give you, you know, we've got food. They're like, OK, sign me up. And so I love seeing like that, seeing this event happen in other places because it's just such a great way to connect people.
As you think about the past and the events you've been involved in, can you think of some striking findings or just interesting findings that have happened that maybe people weren't aware, you know, were going to happen?
Yeah. I mean, every year we find something that's significant in some way. So maybe the property didn't know that it was there in a good way or a bad way. We found things like, you know, sort of special plants, state endangered plants or whatever that the property had no idea that they had. We found things like invasive species that the property didn't know that they had. And that helps them, A, manage that situation either by encouraging that habitat or by helping to remediate that invasive species. We find new state records all the time. We find, again, state endangered, threatened species, sometimes federally endangered species, or federally listed species, I should say. And so every year we find something new. And I would say, depending on the size of the property, we can expect to see 1,000 or more species at an event like this.
Wow.
In 24 hours. And that is, again, it's a very narrow snapshot in time. So surely there is more than 1,000 things out there, but that is what we see in that 24-hour period.
Hmm. Someone else is wondering, is this a competitive event in any way?
It does sometimes get competitive in a very collegial way. The plant folks, the botanists, and the insect people have this long-going war about who's going to put up the most species every year. It's mostly about the species number for them, but it is, in a very, very fun way, competitive, yeah.
Julie, the Leopold Foundation can offer a little incentive to, you know, We'll put up a prize for whatever group comes up with the most number of species.
They will take you up on it, I promise.
Oh, man. So, well, buddy, how many species, plant and animal species, do you think you're going to find at Eldo Leopold?
Well, I think Julia is probably right. It will be thousands or over 1,000. And, you know, kind of to share some of what we know is we know we have about 100 breeding birds species using the property and 300 plus species of plants that we've identified and know. But beyond that, and other individuals that would be even in those guilds of species that we're unaware of, we're just really excited to kind of have our eyes opened and new reveals happen. And of course, we're hoping a little bit more on the fun side than on the problem invasive species side. But as Julia said, knowledge is power, and understanding what's out there and how we can best help the land be as healthy as possible is really important to us.
And I expect that, your own survey work is probably limited compared to what you're going to find of this biodiversity.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we've invested a little bit in having some knowledge and expertise on staff around plants and birds, primarily grassland birds, because those are the species that we feel our habitat can help the best. But on the invertebrates and in the pollinator realm, that's really just knowledge we don't have on our team. And so, again, to Julia's point, knowing what's out there and kind of where they are can really help us continue to build our own knowledge and then ensure that the habitat is as healthy as possible.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about the foundation itself and the property itself for those who aren't familiar with it. You got a lot of acreage there.
Yeah, so again, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that 90 years ago, the Leopold family purchased this little farm outside of Baraboo, Wisconsin, on the Wisconsin River, and it was a worn-out farm. They began to restore it to health, and then that became kind of the inspiration for Leopold's seminal work, now a Sand County Almanac, which I'm guessing a lot of your listeners have heard of, but it's become one of the cornerstone pieces of literature in the environmental conservation movement, been translated into 15 different languages. And so we still own and manage the farm that is a National Historic Landmark now. And then we also are the executor of Leopold's Literary Estate. So we help bring the book out in new packages and new language and new formats, make sure his idea of a land ethic, which he articulated in that book, remains vital and relevant. And that is basically that we're all in this together. We're all part of the land community. And for people to be healthy, the land has to be healthy. And then as a way to continue the family's commitment to ecological restoration and management, we've partnered with neighboring landowners, primarily the Pines family that owns a significant amount of land adjacent to us. And so now we help take care of this 4,000 acres of contiguous land on both sides of the Wisconsin River to kind of manage for our targets, our grassland birds, bees and monarch butterflies specifically. So again, those are the ones that kind of we know most about, but looking to have our eyes open about what else is out there.
Yeah. Well, and the property is amazingly diverse.
It is. You know, we sit in this kind of part of Wisconsin where you have a lot of natural divisions that kind of collided literally and figuratively mm-hmm. with where the glacier, the last extent of the last glaciation, and then where the Wisconsin River came through, Glacial Lake, Wisconsin was drained. You have the Baraboo Hills and the Quartzsite Mountain Range not far from us. And so Sauk County is kind of, which is the county that the farm is in, holds 50% of all the state's plant and animal species. So we sit in this kind of hot spot for biodiversity. And again, that's why we know it's a diverse area, but better understanding exactly what that diversity is and knowing what's there that we're stewards of is really important.
Yeah, I would think. And Julia, how did the selection process go for this anyway? I'm wondering how you landed on, I can see why you'd want to land on the Leopold Center, but talk about that.
Yeah, so we select sites in a variety of ways. Often the site approaches us and says, hey, we're really interested. And so we'll have a meeting to make sure that everybody's, you know, goals and expectations line up. But we are interested in sites that are super diverse and like Alda Leopold, somewhat rural. But we're also interested in sites that are, you know, urban parks. We did Grant Park a couple years ago, a couple parks in Waukesha, because you can find, you know, nature is everywhere. It's not just in some far-flung area or some rainforest halfway across the globe. Like, diversity is in your own backyard, and it just helps us sort of drive that message home, I think.
Yeah. I was thinking about Milwaukee. I mean, it in and of itself, the number of the amount of parkland and natural areas. I mean, you think about Milwaukee. Most people, I think, would think about, well, maybe they think about the Brewers, or maybe they think about the downtown area. But you have a lot there that you can that you could study.
Yeah, there's a lot of parkland. A lot of it has had pretty extensive restoration or ecological work done on it. And this not only helps highlight work like that, like they at Leopold, you know, there's a lot of prairie restoration, and so we can talk about that, but it also helps sort of evaluate how those things have done and are doing depending on what we find in various places. At Leopold, one of the things I'm personally very excited about is there's prairies that we know are 90 years old restoration, so restored prairie places. And then there's some that are, what, buddy, a year or two old at
Correct.
This point?
Yeah.
And
brand new.
What's the difference between those? What are we going to find? Are we going to, you know, are we going to find really rare stuff in both? Are we just going to find it in one? So that's a really exciting way that we can gather data.
So it gets pinpointed then. Any finding?
Yes.
As to location.
Yeah. So we are doing a lot. We're trying to be very careful about that this year because there are these different, distinctly different restoration zones on the property. So scientists will hand us the list that says, oh, I was in zone one or zone five when I found this. If they're using the program iNaturalist, that auto adds GPS, and so then they can map it out that way.
Oh, that's nice.
And so these zones, you know, will help us track where these different species were located and identified. But also for us, we know, well, where did we burn last year, or how long it's been 5 years since this zone was burned. And so that's the other thing that informs our management moving forward is not only just what's there, maybe because of how old or diverse the habitat is, but also the historic management that has occurred on that zone.
I think that's pretty interesting because you do have sort of time zones. I was thinking, well, it'd be fun to be able to go back to an area, Julia, at some point and say, okay, we're going to do this again here, and what are the differences? And in the case of the foundation, you have sort of time differences in terms of the property itself.
Yeah, so in terms of like when it was last burned is a big one, or when it was restored, and in 10 years it would be fascinating to go back to those very recent prairies and see what they're doing.
And that, again, we'll have this now rich data set, and so where we find interesting insights or questions, you know, whether we'll be able to recruit Julia and NPM to come back to do a full bio blitz, don't know. But we could engage scientists and specialists to kind of look a little further and deeper into one area or species and why was there or not there based on all this contextual information.
I'm thinking you could target then, too, if there's something you find that you didn't know was there.
Right.
And you want it to be there, and maybe more of it to be there.
Correct.
Yeah. You can target it that way. Somebody else is wondering how can members of the public get involved in the BioBlitz this weekend, or can they? You know, I think they can show up.
Yeah. So definitely 10 to 3, we will be there. And if you are an iNaturalist user, anybody can join the expedition. We'll have QR codes on site. And as long as you're within the bounds of, you know, the survey area that we've set up before 3 o'clock, start snapping away.
That's pretty cool. So So there can be some overlap from the sound of it in terms of what gets cited.
Yes. Yeah. So we definitely have to, there's a step there where at like 2:30, we are frantically going through everybody's lists and, okay, so-and-so saw this and so-and-so also saw this. So make sure it's recorded once and not twice. And then we do go back and data check the list after because it's a little chaotic at the end. But yeah, there's definitely overlap where multiple lists will come in with the same thing. But then you always find that one unique thing on the list and nobody else saw it.
Have you, and does that happen pretty often?
Oh yeah. Like they will come in, you know, oh, I just saw whatever. And then everybody else goes out to look for it and maybe they get lucky. Maybe they don't, but sometimes you just have to be in the right place at the right time.
They're a little hooping and hollering going
yeah.
on.
Maybe. Oh yeah.
Oh, I love that. Oh man. By the way, I did want to mention, and I should have mentioned this earlier, but I couldn't find my notes on it. But there is, on a different topic here, tomorrow we have a one-day member drive ourselves. And I did want to point that out. It's a one-day drive, and it works when we get an early start. Works best. So as you're listening in today, you can help us meet the goal of 1,200 donations. We're moving along. We haven't made it yet, but we need to make 1,200 donations by the 26th of June. So when you give a donation now, WPR programs will receive an extra $12,000 from a group of generous members. So you can join in now with your gift at WPR.org/donate. That really, really help us out. Go to WPR.org/donate and make a contribution now. And that's going to help us out here at WPR. Love that. I'm wondering about the costs of all. Let's go back to the event. Is it an expensive thing to put on, Julia?
Yeah, there's definitely costs associated. We have to get a tent. We have to get all of our staff out there. We're feeding people. There's t-shirts and all these consumables. It's supported by very generous donors. This year we have the Antonia Foundation, PPG is donating, and then David and Marguerite Harvey have been longtime supporters of this event. And so that allows us to put this on for free, to provide programming for free, and then... You know, if there's things that the site needs subsidized, like parking or whatever, we can do that as well.
Yeah. And Buddy, on your end, what about it?
No particular special investment, kind of just part of our ongoing operations. So our staff team that is supporting the scientists, getting out to the field and kind of helping refine where they're at. But it's just a great opportunity for us to get new knowledge, but also new faces out to the Leopold Center that have never been there but are motivated to come out to participate or to learn about what's being found. And, you know, I just put a quick plug in for all your listeners to support the Leopold Foundation, Milwaukee Public Museum, and Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, our communities are not strong and resilient without your support. And this is a great kind of triangulation of interest and expertise right here on the radio right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine even the experts, they're probably doing this on their own time, a lot of them.
Yeah, they, you know, this is sometimes it's work for them, but often it's, you know, they're coming on a day off and they, we have the advantage, as I said earlier, that they love doing this stuff and we give them a chance to, really.
Yeah, and I want to give you guys a chance to talk a little bit more about some other things, too, that, I mean, the foundation always has a lot going on, but you talk about some of the things that are coming up that people might also be interested in.
Well, obviously, if you can't join us this weekend, you can still come out pretty much any day through the end of October to see the historic Leopold Shack and Farm, visit the Leopold Center. We also have virtual programming called Land Ethic Live that's once a month. Next month, our guest is Dick Cates. Many people in southern Wisconsin will know him. He and his family have written a book about their journey to implement the land ethic on their farm from a sustainable agriculture perspective. And then a really fun time to come visit us is in November when we have our crane tours and co-host Crane Fest with the International Crane Foundation. So, you know, one of Wisconsin's conservation success stories is that when the Leopolds purchased their farm in the 30s, there was only about 100 cranes in all of Wisconsin. And now our flyway has about 100,000. And we have about 15,000 of them come to roost every night right behind the shack in the Wisconsin River. And so it's just a great wildlife spectacle. So this weekend we will find some really small things that you can only see under a microscope, but anybody can come out and see sandhill cranes land right in front of them in November.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be a very quiet event.
Talk about hooping and hollering.
Oh, man. Julia, what about the museum?
So in addition to the BioBlitz in Baraboo, because Baraboo is a distance from the museum, we are doing BioBlitz-related programming at the museum with our educators on site, and that's on Saturday. And then upcoming, we have the Dinosaur Days of Summer next month, which is July 7th to the 25th. So that's 3 weeks of all the dinosaur programming that you could ever want, I think. Should be very good. And then we have ongoing things like member appreciation, special events, tours like Secrets of the Museum that are included with admission.
I haven't visited the museum in a couple of years, so I got to get back over there.
Yeah, now's the time. We are gearing up for this move. So,
yeah, for sure. Well, I tell you what, it's been a pleasure talking with both of you today. And so what's the time, just as we conclude here, when should people come out this weekend, buddy?
Saturday from 10 to 3. And, again, there's a schedule, full schedule on the Milwaukee Public Museum website if you want to take a hike or a workshop. But 10 to 3 is open to the public.
And it's this is a free event.
Free.
Yep.
Yeah.
Come learn. Come listen. Learn.
The price. Laugh. The price is right.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Well, I tell you what. This I know it's going to be a lot of fun. Thank you both very much for taking time to talk with us about it. Appreciate it. And we'll have a chance to do it again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Buddy Hoffecker is Executive Director and Board President for the Aldo Leopold Foundation based in Baraboo. And Julia Colby is the Manager of the Vertebrate and Invertebrate Collection at the Milwaukee Public Museum. That's going to be a great event. And if you're looking for something to do this weekend and I know just the place you can go. We've just been talking about it for the last 45 minutes. Coming up, we're going to take a look at organic farming and some events that are going to be of interest to a lot of folks who are interested in organic farming. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to organic farming. You know, organic farmers are always looking for ways to grow local demand for their crops. And starting today, as a matter of fact, UW-Madison's Organic Agriculture Field Days will help farmers and consumers find each other, and we're talking about that today, about these organic agriculture field days with Erin Silva. She is program leader for the Organic Grain Reserve and Information Network, OGRAIN. It hosts events, and Erin's a professor, extension specialist at UW-Madison's Department of Plant Pathology and the Cliff Bar Endowed Chair in organic agriculture and outreach. And we've had a chance to work together on a thing or two over time. And so it's great to have her with us today. And I hope you'll join in as we move along today. Would you buy more locally produced organic produce if it was readily available? Do you assume, maybe you think it's too expensive, or is it more expensive than other foods? If so, do you understand why? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234.
604-281-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Aaron Silva, welcome. Good to have you with us today.
Thanks, Larry. I'm so glad to join you today. Excited to talk about our programming.
Yeah, it's really cool. This is up today is the first of 5 UW-Madison's Organic Agriculture Field Days. And these field days will be taking place throughout Wisconsin and Illinois. So tell us about the field days. What can people kind of expect?
Sure. So the field days are focused on organic grain production. UW-Madison has extensive programming to support organic farming throughout Wisconsin. And there's a good reason why we do that. Wisconsin has long been a leader in organic agriculture. Behind California, we have the second highest number of organic farms out of any state in the nation, which is quite an accomplishment. So organic farming is a big part of our agricultural landscape. And organic farming supports a lot of smaller family farms that do supply into local markets. So it's a big part of our rural economies. It's a big supporter of keeping farms in family businesses and keeping people in farming. So UW-Madison has been committed to supporting organic farming and helping those farmers be able to be successful in organic farming. And again, having that translate into economic security, not only for the family, but for our rural economies, which we really want to continue to see thriving throughout the state. So our series of field days, these are grain focused. We have a lot of organic vegetable farms, but what we are focusing on within this series that you mentioned is grain farming. So anything from corn to soybeans to wheat to rye, and a lot of those grains not only go to feed our livestock industry, including our organic dairy industry, which again, Wisconsin is a leader, not only in dairy generally, but in organic dairy, but also going into products that we get to enjoy too at our dining room tables, breads and pastries, and even beer and spirits, which is the focus of some of our field days.
You didn't mention barley, and I thought, well,
barley is in there too. Barley is in there too. So we do produce organic beer.
So the I'm thinking about the sales. I was looking at some numbers on the sales of organic products. And it was over $71 billion. You can talk about that.
Yes, yeah. So we've had a certified a USDA certified organic program since 2002. So almost over 20 years now of a federal regulation. So we've had data collected since 2002 to measure the growth in the organic industry and measure consumer demand. And despite the ups and downs of our economy and the challenges that consumers face in terms of grocery store prices and just increased food prices in general, organic still continues to grow. Consumers are maintaining and growing their interest in organic, choosing organic not only for the interest in their own family's health, but also the health of the environment. So indeed, organic sales have reached over the threshold that you mentioned. So we're seeing a continued consumer demand, and again, a reflection of consumers' interest in being able to support the benefits that organic provides.
And I'm seeing, I think the trend was something like 4% at least every year increase in sales of products, organic products. So a steady increase across time.
Indeed, which again, I think really reflects consumer commitments because we've certainly within that time frame experienced recessions and some economic challenges as a country. So the fact that we are seeing that continued increase is really a reflection of the interest of consumers to supporting organics.
So the field days are organized by your group, the Organic Grain Resource and Information Network, or OGRAIN, which mm-hmm. you lead.
talk about the organization itself, its mission, and that sort of thing.
Yes. So as well as being a professor in the College of Ag and Life Sciences, I'm also supported by the Division of Extension. So the O-Grain program is an extension program. UW Extension have been helping farmers for over a century now, and O-Grain is continuing that mission of supporting our farmers throughout the state. So within the O-Grain program, we help to connect farmers with the research we do at the university, not only the research within my program, but also research done by other faculty, anywhere from breeding for organics, breeding cereal grains for organic production, which is going to be part of the emphasis this evening at our West Madison Research Station, looking at how to manage diseases organically, looking at how to be able to manage our soils that align with the federal regulation for organic production. So we have a lot of research that we're able to communicate through our O-Grain programming. And we also are a way for farmers to connect and build community. Farmers learn a lot from other farmers. Farmers are experts in their own right and generate so much information and data from their years of experience farming. So a big part of what we do is create space and community for farmers to connect with other farmers. And that's a big emphasis of our field days as well. Allowing a space for farmers to get onto other organic farmers' farms and see what they're doing and learn something new from those that are doing it and doing it well.
You know, the focus this year, I kind of like the focus, it's resilience and diversification. Mm-hmm. How are these important issues for organic farmers?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we reflect over our past several springs, we've swung from having droughts to having excessive rains to having cool temperatures. So there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of the weather that we can expect from year to year. I mean, that can be a challenge for farming. If we have a delay of getting into the field, delays in terms of our ability to manage weeds and insects and diseases, it can be a challenge for farmers to be able to have the productivity that they need to stay economically viable. So a big part of what we're trying to do with our research is to learn more about how can farmers create systems, specifically organic farmers in the case of the O-Grain program, that buffers them from some of the negative impacts of the weather uncertainty and the ups and downs of the weather that we've been experiencing over the last decade or even more. So that's a big piece of the resilience is the production resilience, but that directly translates to the financial resilience and making sure that those farms are economically viable. And again, a big emphasis of keeping our rural economy strong and keeping people farming on the landscape that want to go into farming. We still have a lot of young people that want to get into farming, but we need to make sure that it's a profession that they can make a living to support themselves and their families.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark in Wisconsin Dells has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
A large commercial field of corn and soybeans that are organic fields produce four people in Illinois per seed. And my concern is that there are thousands of acres, perhaps tens of thousands of acres, our forest land that has been.
Shucks, we lost Mark. That's too bad. Mark's a crop inspector for large commercial organic fields.
Oh wow!
I'm sorry we lost him. And I'm wondering if his comments related to if you have large organic farm fields producing
crop or producing seed, is there an issue or a problem with supply and demand here is what I think he was going, where I think he was going.
Yeah, it's in terms of supply and demand, there with and that's actually is a good segue into our diversification emphasis. So I could maybe explain a little bit more of why we're emphasizing there. So with any sector of farming, we don't want to overproduce because then our prices go down and then we have challenges with that economic viability that is so critical to our rural economies and to the quality of life for our farming communities. So we whereas corn and soybean are still a major part of the organic market, feeding not only our amazing organic dairies throughout the state, but the organic poultry industry and other parts of organic livestock production, diversification allows for farmers to be able to produce for market sectors where there may not be as much product being developed. And some of that is the cereal grains, the food that goes or the product that goes into food grade consumption. So again, a lot of our emphasis is highlighting the research and what farmers are doing to move on beyond corn and soybean production, which again is an important part of our ag economy, including organic. But how can they grow other crops, including the barley and the rye and the wheat and the oats, that allow their farms to be more resilient and allows them to be able to access additional markets so that we don't get into a situation where we are oversupplying a certain sector and then prices are getting depressed.
Aaron Silva, our guest today, program leader for the Organic Grain Resource and Information Network, which is hosting UW-Madison's Organic Agriculture Field Days. It's great to have her with us. Questions for her or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at what's going on in organic farming today, and specifically with our Organic Grain Resource and Information Network, which hosts the UW-Madison's Organic Agriculture Field Days. Aaron Silva, our guest today. It's great to have her with us. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Mark in the Dells did call back. He said there are tens of thousands of acres of Wisconsin forest that's been converted for growing of organic crops. He's concerned too much of that is happening and is worried that production is low with these crops, not worth the environmental costs from the loss of the forest.
I'm not aware of that dynamic happening. I don't want to. I definitely like to learn more, but I a lot of the farms that I'm aware of that are transitioning. They've either been organic for decades, and often transition because of a family illness. A lot of our farms in Wisconsin have been farming for generations. And as sometimes there's a grandfather or a father that has been farming and is passed away from cancer, and family members are concerned and they're looking for different ways of farming that might not expose family members to chemicals. Some are transitioning part of their fields or all of their land to organic because of market opportunities and the price premiums that tend to come with organic products, and looking at creating more opportunities for the next generation, and often multiple family members from the next generation. Sometimes we see farms that have cousins and brothers and sisters all wanting to continue on the land, and organic offers an opportunity for those multiple generations to maintain farming, which again translates into more vibrant rural communities. So I'm not aware of the dynamic of land being cleared to go into organic production, but again, farmers that are either expanding their organic operations that have been farming for decades or transitioning their land to provide additional opportunities or looking at a different way of farming.
Ed in McFarland will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ed.
Hello. My question is on, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but Kernza wheat variety, if you could talk about pluses and minuses of it, using it as a grain to bake with or utilize however else. I'm familiar with being able to bake with it. And then is it have a possibility of ever becoming commercially, economically viable?
Yeah, those are great questions. And definitely are in the know about some up and coming farming innovations to be aware of Kernza. So Kernza is the commercial name for intermediate wheatgrass. So a lot of the cereal grains that we produce for our food production, including wheat and oats, they're annual crops. So they get planted every year and they get harvested and they get planted again. So typically, there needs to be some soil disturbance that's done, or there needs to be additional management to be able to plant that crop again every year. And that can cause some challenges to the sustainability and the environmental consequences of our farming systems, not only organic, but conventional as well. So the addition of perennial crops that grow multiple years and they stay on the soil, they put down deep root systems. They are so important for our food production systems, including our dairy systems, to maintain our soil and our waterways that are so important for, especially Wisconsin, that really values our recreation and values our beautiful natural areas. So intermediate wheatgrass or Kernza has been developed by the multiple people have been involved in the development, but the Land Institute has been a major driver of the development, the research related to Kernza. And we have researchers at UW-Madison, and I think it'll be highlighted at the field day this evening. University of Minnesota and other land-grant researchers have been involved as well. So Kernza potentially offers a way to continue to produce grains that are so important for our diets, but in a way that will help improve our soils and protect our waterways. The challenge with Kernza is that it tends not to be as productive. It definitely has different profiles in terms of its quality and its potential for use. And we're still working as a farming and scientific community to understand how do we keep it productive in a way that we're able to maintain the productivity we get off of our annual crops. So in terms of the challenges, I know that there's a new variety that's going to be released soon at the University of Minnesota that's going to hopefully help address some of the issues with maintaining productivity of that Kernza variety. There's still a need for more market development. There are some companies that are producing Kernza beer. And there is some Kernza that's being used in various products, oftentimes mixed with other grains that are more typically used within our baking and production of different products that use cereal grains. So there are farmers that are growing it, especially those that are using livestock and have the opportunity to graze it or also use it for feed for the animals as well as potentially for human food. But it's still on a limited scale and probably isn't ready quite yet for being put out on a larger scale on fields. There's some market development that needs to be done as well, but an up-and-coming, exciting innovation, not only for organic farmers, but for conventional farmers as well.
Someone else wonders, do certified organic farmers need to test their soil for chemical infiltration more than traditional farmers?
Testing of the soil for chemicals is not typically part of the organic certification process. So within organic farming, to be a certified organic farmer, there is a 36-month transition period. So that land has to be managed for 3 years, 36 months before a product can be sold as organic. So you can't go directly from a field that's managed conventionally and plant something and sell it as organic. So there's time for that land to transition. And then there are strict regulations in terms of the products that a farmer can use. And that's regulated through a yearly inspection process where someone goes out, walks the fields, looks at the inventories on the farms, looks at all the receipts and products that the farmer has purchased. So it's a very rigorous but voluntary inspection process, voluntary in the sense that you don't have to be organic, but if you are organic, it's a regulation that you need to go through this process. So there's a lot of oversight in organic, but it's more of a process that relates to the practices that a farmer's doing and less on the testing of either the soils or the product itself. But because of the fact that the farmers are using very specific inputs, typically the products themselves are less exposed to chemicals, or there's less residue or presence of chemicals on the soils and product.
Let's talk about that field day this afternoon, because there's still time. I mean, there's 3 hours yet before the event starts. What are people going to find at the event, and again, where?
So the event is at our West Madison Agriculture Research Station. So it's just on the west side of the town. So not too far from the UW-Madison campus. Easy to find, the West Madison Agriculture Research Station. And the researchers will be taking participants out to the field and seeing the research, particularly with some of the breeding efforts, to look at developing crop varieties that are more adapted to organic management. So whether it be resilience to diseases and insects, or particularly have the qualities that consumers want in terms of flavor or the baking quality that our bread makers might want. So there's specific aspects that the breeders are looking for that are specifically geared towards organic farming and markets. So participants will be able to walk through the fields, hear about what the researchers have been doing, and be able to see those different varieties firsthand.
And the other field days, we've got other ones coming up in La Crosse. Could you run through where those other events are?
Yeah, so our July 17th field day is just north of La Crosse, not too far outside of that city. And that is on the McHugh farm. And the McHughs have been extremely innovative in their production practices. They have a fantastic composting operation that helps improve their soils. And they have diversified into specifically producing products for La Crosse Distillery. So the group will also be heading back into La Crosse to be able to sample some of those products firsthand. So that's one of our field days that really does span from the farm field to consumers. So that will be a fun day. And then August 19th at Otter Creek Farm, which is in the Driftless region. It's in Spring Green, Wisconsin. So beautiful, beautiful area of Wisconsin. And again, they're doing some great innovations to help protect our soil, to be able to introduce rye into the rotation, which is something that humans as well as livestock can eat, and a specific emphasis on soil health. And a big part of organic agriculture is protecting our soil, which then helps our productivity and also helps protect our environment. So fun field day there.
And where can people find more information on all of the field days, because there's more of them?
There are. So if you Google O-Grain, you'll be able to come to our website. It's O-G-R-A-I-N, O-Grain, and you'll be able to find the information there.
Aaron, fun talking with you today. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but appreciate your efforts, your work first, and your efforts for these field days. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Always fun to be on.
Aaron Silva, program leader for
OGRAIN, the Organic Grain Resource and Information Network. Thanks to her, and thank you very much for joining in today and listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.